Football on Off the Ball.
The sense is, and this is such an odd thing to say of a team who are 5 points clear at the top of the league, but the sense is their heads have gone.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Here it comes, opportunity, O'Reilly! The League of Ireland is back this Friday night on Off the Ball, whatever the weather.
Can you believe it?
A team of distinction and real big spenders, Derry City host Bohemians after their 4-goal haul last weekend.
An instant response from Derry City.
Can City get off to a good start for a change, or will Bowes get that loving Whelan?
Back pass here, Colin Whelan has scored for Bohemians.
There's sure to be fireworks on Foyle side. Join us on Off the Ball this Friday from 7 p.m. on News Talk or the Goal Out app for live and exclusive commentary of Derry City versus Bohemians.
A beautiful finish.
League of Ireland on Off the Ball.
Off the Ball Daily.
Welcome back. So as you'll have seen this week, the IRFU is investigating the racist abuse directed at Edwin Adogbo around last weekend's Six Nations win for Ireland over Italy. Specifically, there were posts on X and on Instagram around Adogbo's debut that were met with a number of racist comments. The IRFU turned off comments on a number of posts, and they said they're going to continue to work with Signify, which is a data technology company which specialises in protecting against online abuse. So we wanted to dig a little bit deeper in this and what an investigation like this might actually look like. So very happy to say that John Sabir, one of Signify's co-founders and head of investigations, is with us on the line. John, a very good evening to you. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
And Kieran O'Connor of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue is also with us on the line. Kieran, how are you keeping?
Very well, Owen. Thanks. How are you?
All good. So let's start with what the IRFU are actually doing here. So, John, from your perspective, Signify was appointed by the IRFU last August for your threat matrix. So this provides year-round protection when it comes to online abuse and threats for Irish rugby players across all levels. So what actually happens on a week like this, John, when something very specific and very high profile actually does occur?
Yes. So ThreatMetrics is a service that essentially monitors all public social media and comments that are directed onto the public accounts of either a governing body, a club, league, or an individual athlete or player themselves. And we're scanning that for anything that is discriminatory or threatening. And then if we pick something up, we're then investigating to see whether or not actually that is correct and that is what it is, and then what potential action might be possible. And that is, in the first instance, dealing with the platform, so the relevant platform that it's on. We help facilitate platform-level action. But then if it's serious enough, beyond that, it may be the case that there's action that IRFU is taking, or clubs, or other bodies. And then if it's serious enough, again, and passes a legal threshold, depending on the jurisdiction we're working in, then it might be the case that that goes through to law enforcement. So there's kind of, we're essentially looking for anything that is targeting players or individuals that passes a discriminatory or legal threshold, and then helping to facilitate action off the back of that.
So the technology here is a combination between AI and human analysis, I understand. So I presume the AI is like a broad stroke process, and then your employees are going through the pieces of or the red flags that the technology actually picks up.
Correct. I mean, AI is wonderful and it is moving forward quickly, but in terms of the nuance and the context and understanding whether or not something is actually meant to be discriminatory and harmful or threatening in context is still something that we find eludes it. And so, yes, we use AI to essentially take a data set that humans just couldn't review because of time down to something that they need to look at that they could review, and then we pay attention to those.
Can I ask, out of interest, since you started working with the IRFU, has there been an incident or has there been a week like this where your alarms have started going off, so to speak?
We have dealt with cases for the IRFU before. We've had a number of different issues. There have been some incidents like this. We've also dealt with fixated fans. So we deal quite a lot with fans whose fandom can sometimes tip over into obsession and harmful behaviours in terms of fixation. And so we have dealt with a case where a fan was exhibiting obsessive behaviours towards a player that was causing them distress. And so We examined that, passed the evidence through to the IRFU, and they did end up passing that through to law enforcement because it had crossed a threshold, and that was dealt with. So there have been a number of cases. I would say that cases like this weekend and serious cases are fortunately few and far between, but we do deal with them when they arise. The majority of the work is essentially helping to deal with platform level, so anything that has breached the platform's own terms and getting them to action that in the way that they commit to doing.
So this week then, what are you seeing? Speaking broadly here, what was thrown up on Saturday? What is your system showing and what are we dealing with?
So unfortunately, this weekend there were a number of explicitly racist posts and comments that came through. They were flagged. We have been dealing with those, and so the as well as flagging the actual posts and comments themselves, and then dealing with the platforms and or relevant authorities on those. The second part that we do is we go and look at the accounts and determine if we can. Make a positive identification in terms of where is the account author actually located, and then if possible who they are. We do that. We only use public data for that process, so we will not compromise privacy settings. We won't we're not hacking people to find out their identity. We are essentially looking at what information is there to determine both a risk factor in terms of if they've threatened somebody, is there a proximity? Are they in the same country? Are they in the same city? Are they actually at the event that is taking place? But if it's something that is perhaps not immediate risk, but there is an aspect, because it's discriminatory abuse, where either the IRFU or others would want to take action, or if it's serious enough to go to law enforcement, that is usually determined by jurisdiction. So we look to determine, is the author of this account actually in Ireland? Therefore, is it possible? Are they attending games? Are they coming there? So is there something that could be done? Lots of clients we work with like to do access sanctions. So they might take away the ability to attend events if you've done this. They might take away the ability to buy tickets. If you're a season ticket holder or a regular ticket holder, they might take away that from you, either for a ban, so a short period of time, or in perpetuity, so a complete ban. So we're looking for... where is the account located? And if possible, who is the author of the account? Because that allows an extra step of action to be taken.
Do we know where the vast majority of the racist abuse towards Edmund Odogba was coming from? Are we talking about a large percentage outside of Ireland?
I think in this case, there are certainly accounts that we are looking at that are outside of Ireland, but there are also accounts that were located inside Ireland as well.
Okay, fair enough. Kieran, really fascinated to get your take on all of this, because this is a subject that you have worked on for many years, where this has naturally existed in a largely political / societal sphere. And certainly I made the mistake on Monday of going on to X and looking at some of the comments in question regarding Edwin Odogbo. And there is a real bang of the anonymous right-wing bots that you would associate with certain aspects of Irish political discourse, let's say. So this is something that you've been dealing with. This is very much of the same school. So talk to us about this, when something like this happens, in terms of the anonymity of profiles, in terms of this apparent movement that tends to happen online in a very, very racist way.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, I think, with some of the things that John mentioned there. I mean, the abuse that I saw aimed at Odogbo ranged from the explicit slurs that John mentioned based on the color of his skin or his ethnicity or his heritage, broader insults as well, but then some conspiratorial claims is probably the best way to describe them, claims that Odogbo's appearance for Ireland was somehow evidence of what's called the Great Replacement Theory. This is a conspiracy theory that's been growing in popularity online, especially for the last few years. And it claims that the population of majority white countries are being systematically replaced with people of color. And this is being carried out in some sinister way by governments or international bodies or institutions like that. And this is not the first time that we've seen this kind of abuse in such a networked way aimed at people of colour. Even in the Irish context, we saw the under-21s team, or I think the under-15s team, sorry, attacked online back in 2023 because of the diverse makeup of that team. More recently, in June 24, Rashida Adeleke suffered online abuse as well after competing at the European Athletic Championships as well. The abuse that we're kind of seeing at people like this, it's part of the broader context of not just Ireland, many countries over the last few years, where we've seen not just the growth, but kind of the normalization of racist abuse happening in the same way that lots of normal and genuine trends can take off on social media. So too do these trends that are based exclusively in racism and hate as well. And the kind of networked nature of this is that this, of course, includes online users, people based in Ireland, but also people based in other countries too. And that raises serious challenges for any form of accountability or perhaps potential legal action against these figures. I saw one explicitly racist post mentioning Idogbo, and through my own just exploration of that account, saw that they're based in the United States. So there's very little recourse, it seems, that can be taken against this kind of activity. And as I said, the kind of broader context of this is that in the last number of years, again, not just in Ireland, but as we're discussing here today, we've seen the kind of growth or a surge in, unfortunately, explicitly hateful and racist or exclusionary anti-migrant rhetoric, sometimes verging on extremist or far-right exclusionary terms as well. And that's why we see, I think it plays a large role in how we see more and more of this kind of content, because those kinds of people who espouse those kinds of beliefs are terminally online in many cases, and they pick up and capitalize on any kind of incident or, you know, potential moment offline in the real world that they can then put forward their beliefs and agendas.
When it comes to some of the conspiracy theories that you mentioned there, it does seem that some of them are a creation from a place that is hard to pin down. Where geographically are we talking about here? Because it does seem that a lot of them are actually coming from outside of Ireland, and yet it does seem that it manages to get its fangs into an Irish story or an Irish figure, whether it's Rashida, whether it's Edwin Adogbo, and this sort of international feeling of whatever this conspiracy theory is tends to embed itself into an Irish sports story, which is a really, really strange thing. It just makes the operations of a company like Signify, a company like the IRFU, an organisation like the IRFU, it makes it really, really difficult, Kieran, because what exactly is the outcome of an investigation that they're looking for when the genesis of a conspiracy isn't even in your jurisdiction?
It's incredibly difficult, and conspiratorial narratives or rhetoric often don't fall foul of, you know, platform community guidelines, maybe don't fall foul of kind of the legal threshold or illegal threshold for a hateful or illegal abuse against people. It's more based in claims, and conspiracies themselves are ever expanding, they're self-sealing, they're essentially elastic and can be used. Something like the Great Replacement Theory, it began its life amongst a kind of a fringe band of far-right ideologues about 15, 20 years ago, give or take. And in that time since, it's travelled broadly around Europe, around North America, around the world. In the last few years in Ireland, it's been kind of localised. If you spend any time on X, I share your sentiments, I try and limit my time as well on that platform own. But you may see, if you look at discussions of Irish immigration from explicitly far-right accounts, you'll see them talking about a new plantation, because this is a kind of Irish localized conception of the great replacement happening before our eyes. So people who espouse these beliefs find new ways or find new targets all the time as a way of preservation, I think, and expansion for these conspiracy theories. And it's representative of a broader growth in Ireland, and again internationally, of ethno-nationalism, not to get too in the weeds on a kind of academic terminology there, but this is how people who preach or believe in ethno-nationalism would believe that nationality should be defined solely by your ethnicity and nothing else. And that is so wound up or tied up in the growth of the far right, a lot of anti-immigrant perspectives as well. And it's how we see, I think it explains a lot of the kind of increased popularity and increased spillover events of, you know, networked racist abuse like this.
Well, that's a really fascinating point, Kieran, because it brings us on to what tech companies can or can't do. So the ideology of ethno-nationalism, I guess, under the guise of X as it is right now, and even to be fair, when it comes to Meta platforms, that's not seen as something that's enough to get you booted off one of those platforms, and therefore this mushrooms.
No, it's not. So all of these large social media platforms, they all have quite detailed, quite nuanced community guidelines stating what is and is not prohibited on those platforms. And every user that signs up to those platforms agrees to those guidelines, agrees to those rules, even if they go on to become kind of repeat offenders and violating them. But in these guidelines, as it relates to the kind of thing we're talking about here today, content that which, you know, dehumanizes, harasses, targets people based on what are called their protected characteristics. So things like race, ethnicity, religion, things like this, that kind of content is explicitly prohibited on most of the largest social media platforms. And yet when you see Idogbo being referred to by, you know, the worst racial slurs that we know of, they are clear violations of these terms, of these guidelines rather. And yet this content, so often is the case, seems to not only be able to remain on this platform, but also contribute towards wider trends, perhaps get algorithmically boosted on these accounts, on these platforms, if the user is perhaps verified or, you know, a kind of monetized user of the platform too. So there's what we call an enforcement gap on platforms. There's the kind of space between what platforms say they're going to do with certain kinds of content that is prohibited versus what they do or fail to do. And in that space, in that enforcement gap, is where you see so much of the most kind of problematic or harmful content that is able to exist and remain online today.
It's really fascinating. John, if you want to come in on the enforcement gap point that Kieran is making there, it just must present to you a whole suite of new challenges that you can, you know, you obviously have to deal with the jurisdiction piece that we've already touched on, and then people who are blatantly breaching community guidelines are still in existence and possibly even being boosted by the platform on which they exist.
No, I mean, I recognize a lot of what Kieran's just talked about, and it's one of the key roles that we're trying to play is to bridge that enforcement gap as far as possible. And I mean, I was thinking while you were talking about the fact that a lot of the posts from the weekend that we're currently dealing with and getting platforms to take action on, it are posts that do not use explicit slurs, but are doing things like using the phrase "know the difference," and there will be a picture of a white athlete who is held up as an Irishman, and then of Edwin, and, you know, it's trying to splice the difference between the two. And in and of itself, that language is benign, but it's the image and the totality of what the implication is that makes it problematic. And platforms, in the way that they are looking to enforce and to kind of regulate themselves on what content isn't allowed prior to other people pointing it out, that benign language and those kind of images are going to slip through. And so one of the things we are doing, and the direction of travel for platforms is one conversation, but in sport does actually give us a lever to be able to go to platforms and have a conversation, because with those specific sporting teams, we are able to go and have those conversations and say, look, this is something that you won't have picked up, but we can tell you that this is meant to cause harm, and it has caused harm, and the player or the person who is being targeted has seen this, and so it has kind of achieved its goal. You need to action this because this isn't allowed under your kind of terms. And also, we're going to take it through and try and get other action taken off the platforms as well. But in terms of those conversations, those grey areas and are where we're trying to work and bridge that enforcement gap. But it's also, it's the place where the evolution of abuse and the evolution of threat is the most creative, because as soon as you deal with one way of doing it, then another, you know, another phrase, another emoji, another particular image will be kind of brought in. And so then we'll have to deal with that. So there is a constant developing narrative that we have to deal with in terms of how people put those views forward.
That's amazing. Like, it's grim, but that's amazing. Kieran, I presume that's something you've tracked as well throughout your own work, the sort of morphing of the language that you see online.
It is, yeah. It's so interesting to hear that example from John, because again, so much of this stuff does not feature the most explicit of terms. It's more, even if you think about, I don't know, a tweet, there's the content of a tweet, then there's someone who may share that tweet and they don't need to use explicit language themselves to kind of in effect boost the tweet they're sharing. In the same way, a TikTok post contains many kind of constituent parts of it too that can be all individually used benignly, but together can form some form of a hateful message. And that's all, says nothing either about memes and the kind of way that visual content can be used to signal forms of hate or racism online as well, or even emojis. I mean, it's a whole field of its own, but there's always been racist attitudes and racist behavior in the kind of offline pre-digital and digital world. What's so different now is the speed and the scale and the reach that this kind of content can have, and the impact that this content can have, not just on these athletes themselves, but also their family, their friends, just general people too, to see this kind of stuff online. So it's enormously important that there's, you know, figures or organizations like Signify or others who are trying to match the kind of circumstances of the day with tools and resources that can help either athletes or public figures. There's a whole host of, you know, politicians and other forms of people who are on the receiving end of abuse like this all the time as well, because for people who, you know, live their lives in the public eye, perhaps they do receive torrents of abuse via social media, and that is an unfortunate and sad fact. So it's important that there's also things pushing in the other direction too.
John, just as a final point for you before I let you go, the positive account identification piece that you mentioned earlier on, obviously you can only work with data that's been provided by the user to the platform. Is there anything else that you can actually do to get around that situation in the most flagrant cases of racist abuse, for example, online?
Well, there are two aspects to it, and essentially we are trying to do the legwork or the initial work that others, whether it's the platforms or law enforcement, can then take and add to if required, partly because of resource issues in terms of dealing with this that arise both with law enforcement and kind of platforms themselves. So we will do initial footprinting of any public data that is there that allows you to look at the identity of the account owner or the location of the account owner. But then if it is, you know, if it is something where it's not possible publicly to discern those details, then if it's serious enough, we'll go to law enforcement and they can request additional data from the platforms that is only shared with law enforcement. And that includes data that they can use to determine identity. There are limitations to that because if, you know, for example, a law enforcement agency gets the data back and it determines that the account is based in another country, it's, you know, there are some law enforcement agencies will take that forward. Others, that will be the end point of the possibility to deal with that. But we are doing work around any publicly available data around an account that is we're able to do to provide information back to IRFU or others about who this is and whether or not there is any kind of tangible relationship between them. Because ultimately, especially in sports, all of these organizations are membership organizations, and you know, you're buying a ticket, you're coming in, you're buying access to the players, to the other fans, to stewards, to officials. And, freedom of speech is often pushed back on us in terms of, are we infringing that? Our answer to that is no, you're free to have those opinions and to express them, but you're not free from the consequences of what that might mean. And particularly for sports organizations, access is a privilege, it's not a right. And they can take that away if you've engaged in this behavior. And they, it's behavior that doesn't reflect the values that they want to have associated with your ability to access fixtures and being fans of those organizations.
Kieran, I've got a couple more questions for you, but John, I know you got to run, so we'll just take a quick break. John, thanks very much.
No problem. Thank you both. Thank you.
So a chance now with less than 2 minutes to go. Kempes versus Shelton. No chance. 2-2. Kempes' second goal. Shelton was left without a hope.
Mario Kempes, the star of Argentina's first World Cup triumph in 1978, scored a whopping 303 goals over the course of his career, which included spells at Valencia, Rosario Central, River Plate and Instituto. But what if his career had taken a different path and ended up at Spurs? Well, just years after helping his nation win their first World Cup, he nearly joined his fellow countrymen in Ozzy Ardiles and Ricky Villa at the North London club. But why didn't the deal get over the line? Well, in episode 4 of Richie McCormack's Sliding Doors, Richie explains why the transfer didn't come to fruition for one of the best strikers in the world of the 70s and 80s. Find this week's episode in your OTB football podcast feed for free each and every Monday. You can also go back and listen to the other episodes in this series focusing on Michael Laudrup, Pelé and Ronaldo. Subscribe in your OTB football podcast feed now.
Kieran, just to round up this conversation, there's a number of really interesting themes that John has brought up there. The fixated fans, the positive account identification aspects of it all. It does feel that no matter what field you're in at the moment, whether you're a sports person, a person of note due to politics, due to culture, if you are a non-white individual who has some sort of prominence, there are a significant amount of opportunities for there to be an online movement against you, and for that online movement to be based on a conspiracy, an element of racism, a strong element of racism, and it feels that this is just the current situation. It feels like it's got to this point where in a sports level it's reached a head last weekend in the Edwin Adogbo situation, but it's been bubbling along, I mean, significantly for the last number of years in a number of other different areas. So your thoughts on all of that and how this actually manages to arrest itself, because it doesn't seem like that's something that's happening at the moment.
Yeah, people of colour receive all kinds of, racist, race-based abuse. Public figures of all shades receive it too. I know Simon Harris received explicit death threats, I think, was it last year as well. The kind of connective tissue to all of this is social media platforms. They're enormously beneficial for, information, for connecting, for reaching news around the world, for lots of, funny, humorous reasons too, etc. But they've also really lowered the barriers towards, expressing hate towards people, targeting people based on their own inherent characteristics, and this becoming a kind of participatory trend that you can join in and you can encourage others to join in, and it becomes a bit, maybe it's kind of irreverent or ironic, or it's fun in its own kind of way for participants of that too. And as well as that, we've seen not just the great replacement theory, but the broad popularization of many conspiracy theories via social media platforms. And there's numerous offline factors, social factors that can contribute towards these kinds of things too. But in the last few years, we've seen this kind of content, these kinds of beliefs grow incredibly popular, and the kind of access platform or the space by which people can become exposed and supportive of these are on social media platforms. And again, these are platforms that have very detailed, very nuanced rules on what is and is not prohibited on their platforms. They're also enormously wealthy and enormously well-resourced companies. And yet, when we see, be it the targeting of Edwin Adogbo, the targeting of Rashida Adeleke, the targeting of Simon Harris, or any other public figure, or people who just get their own forms of harassment and hate on platforms, that is a significant major failing of social media platforms and their responsibility to their users. But it's also an acknowledgement, I think, that these platforms are being used as designed in a very harmful way. And it's a call, I think, for platforms to do more to protect their users and protect others from these platforms being not misused, but used as designed in very harmful ways.
And I guess the very trite thing to say at this point is that, you know, the powers that be in Irish society could rock on down to one of these corporations in Dublin City and knock on the door and say what the hell is going on. But I think we were through this with Grok a couple of weeks ago. That ain't happening anytime soon.
No, accountability is it's an ongoing process, and encouraging platforms to share their responsibility in creating their own, in making their platform safer and kind of contributing to the overall safety of the kind of online ecosystem. But as we saw around Grok, as we've been seeing for a number of years, there are significant challenges with encouraging this kind of positive behavior from platforms. And that's why we see kind of broader conversations around things like legislation to help or to encourage platforms towards those kinds of behaviors. But all the while, we have last week as a flashpoint, there have been various other incidents in the past, and there unfortunately probably will be in the near future as well, because that's how these platforms are being used at current.
Okay, you've been listening to Kieran O'Connor of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Kieran, thanks a million for your time this evening. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks all.
Cheers. And before that was John Sabir, one of Signify's co-founders and head of investigations with the company as well. We'll take a quick break.
Off the Ball Daily.